Hello and welcome back to CFG's podcast. Today we're talking about the charity SORP. Now, for those of you who pay very close attention to charity accounting issues, you'll know that a new SORP is on the way, and CFG has been working closely with members and partners on responding to the consultation, which is closing soon on the 20th of June. For those of you who don't pay such close attention, and I'd imagine that's the vast majority of you, you might be wondering what on earth all this means for you and, more importantly, your organisation. So to help with that question, I'm delighted to be joined by Carol Rudge, who is head of not-for-profit at Anna Cancer Practice, HW Fisher, and Deborah Alcott-Tyler, CEO of Directory of Social Change, DSC. Together, they'll explain what the charity SORP is, how it's changing, and most importantly, why it matters to you. So let's get started. First question, what is the charity SORP exactly, and who is it for? So Deborah, I'll come to you first on that one.
Thank you. So I'm coming at this from a very non-technical accounting point of view. So I'm financially literate, but that's, the most I can claim. But for me, the SORP is a tremendously important document because, in a sense, it underpins our whole system of charity regulation, because it's actually about how charities report on their activities to those people who support them, to their volunteers, to their donors, to the wider world about the work they do. So it's an incredibly important document, and it sets it like a relatively common standard for how charities prepare their accounts, so that when you look at a set of charity accounts, for the most part, with some exceptions, which I know Carol could probably expand on later, for the most part, you are seeing very similar outlines of, where money's come from, where it's going to, and that sort of thing. So it is terribly, terribly important. My sort of slight concern about any SORP, however, is that SORPs are always written, they're sort of aimed at the technical accounting folk who are the ones who are going to implement it. The reality is that most trustees and probably chief executives and certainly chairs of charities are very, very unlikely to read the detail of the SORP. So I just worry that sometimes, because it's a technical thing, the input into it comes from people with technical expertise, and actually it can lose sight of what it's actually there for, which is to guide the provision of information to donors, to beneficiaries, etc.
So if I can come in and maybe look at it from a different angle, and if I can go one stage back, and that's say, first of all, what is FRS 102? So FRS 102 applies to accounts in the UK that give a true and fair view and is the main financial reporting standard in the UK. The charity SORP then takes FRS 102 and applies it and gives guidance for charities. So that's how we get to the charity SORP. And also the charity SORP sets out the trustees' annual report guidance too, which has got a whole raft of information in it. And if you look at a set of company accounts and a set of charity accounts, people often comment that there's a huge amount more information about what a charity does than what a non-charity would do. And then also that the SORP does quite clearly say this SORP requires, and that's to distinguish it between what is in FRS 102 and what's in the SORP. So that's a little bit of a technical background, and also it only is relevant to charities that are preparing accounts on an accruals basis. And of course, a lot of charities don't prepare their accounts on an accruals basis. So for all of those, then it doesn't apply. And then if you also, asked me, who is it actually for? As Deborah said, it's a long, very technical document. So how many people are going to read it? But actually, it is of huge importance to those that are preparing the accounts, obviously, because it's the guide. It's important clearly for auditors, and also useful for a range of other people. But to read the sort of 300 pages or however many it is, that then you've got to actually want to do that, and to want to do that, you've probably got to be somebody who's going to be preparing or auditing the accounts or equivalent.
Thanks, Deborah and Carol. That provides a really good overview of what the SORP is and who might need to engage with it. As mentioned in the intro, a consultation is now underway to consider the new SORP. It's called the Exposure Draft, and it was published in March. The question is, why should charities care about the consultation? Deborah, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, the consultation is actually, it's massively important, but I suspect that lots of people aren't going to engage with it for reasons I sort of talked about earlier, because it's a long draft. And the honest truth is, if you think about governance in our sector, as I do a lot of work with boards, most of them won't, many trustees don't even know what a SORP is. you know, they'll see their annual report and accounts that's been prepared for them, and they'll, you know, agree to it. So I think there's perhaps not as much understanding in boards of trustees as there should be. And the SORP is very long and it's quite technical. However, having said that, when you look at it, it's really only the first 35 pages that are relevant to non-technical people, because it sort of outlines what the purpose is, why it's asking you to include certain information. And it looks, and that tends to focus on the written bit, matching the numbers. But the rest of it, the other 200 and however many pages, are definitely, as Carol said, for the people who prepare the accounts, the more technical guidance and stuff like that. So it is relevant. However, I suspect that the vast majority of charities to whom it applies, because as Carol said earlier, there are many for whom this isn't relevant, but for those to whom it applies, it's probably only going to be read by their finance teams, I suspect, and possibly a treasurer, you know, maybe at a push the finance committee. But that's one of the reasons why I think it's incredibly important for charities to engage with their professional bodies, for example, Charity Finance Group and others, and their auditors and their accountants, so that they can do the work and help and advise about what are the things that charities should be putting into this consultation. So here I would be very heavily relying on my finance professionals to feed back into the SORP consultation rather than trying to do it myself as a layperson.
Yeah, and looking at it from my perspective, you know, one of the things I would say is that if you don't input now, you won't get another chance until the SORP comes out. And that could be quite some time.
Very true.
Quite a long time since the last one came out. And it really does sort of play a crucial role in terms of how charities report. And we need that reporting to be clear and transparent, because that really does make a difference to trust and confidence in the sector. So from my perspective, I think it is really important, but I do absolutely get that an awful lot of it is very technical. But I do think if the finance professionals in charities can as well explain it to the trustees, not all the pretty, but just an overview of what are the key things in here that are changing. It might just help with the whole process of not only the consultation, but then it really importantly, the implementation when everything is finalised.
Yeah, I think those are really good points. I think we'd echo the advice of seeking support from CFG and others on the new SORP, engage in the consultation too, and also to help others to understand what the SORP is as well. Looking at the exposure draft for a moment, what are the changes that really stand out for you and who will be impacted?
So I think, you know, one of the biggest changes is the whole concept of tiering. And the reason, you know, that was brought in is really because everybody was saying, think small charities first. And that's really important, because when you look at the, you know, 165,000 or however many charities it is out there, most are small. And therefore, it was really important that the SORP thinks small first. So that concept of tiering is, as I said, a really important one. And if I just give a little bit of you know, background to the tiering, there are essentially three tiers. There's one of income up to 500,000, so that's tier one. And then there's one of income between 500,000 and 15 million, tier two. And then tier three is income above 15 million. So the aim is really to make sure that the reporting is proportionate depending on the size of the charity. But most of the tiering is actually within the trustees' annual report. So the real financial stuff, you know, this what I call the back half of the accounts, it doesn't really impact there so much at all. It's the trustees' report. So what the SORP is very much trying to do is to lighten the load of the words around what the charity has done, what it's there for, its objective, its financial review, all those sorts of things, so that the smaller charities have to do less of that. But there are quite a lot of things in there that every charity has to do, whatever size, as long as it's following the SORP, in order to comply.
I think that's a really helpful overview of the tiering, Carol. So thanks for that. Deborah, what are your thoughts on the tiering?
Yeah, to be honest, I'm twixt and twither with this, if I'm absolutely honest. It's like, on the one hand, I absolutely see the logic of tiering. You know, it does make sense. But there are a number of things that prickle at the side of my brain about it. The first thing is that an awful lot of our charities fall into tier one, like massively below the income level. So the vast majority of the sector is now actually probably not going to be reporting in a way in which we might want them to if we're, you know, because there's a massive difference between, I think there's about 110,000 charities with incomes of under less than 10,000, but then there's quite a lot that have incomes up to half a million. That's quite a substantial difference. And so I just worry that those ones are going to get lost somehow. The other thing I worry a little bit about is that it's based on size, like the amount of money the charity has. But I think there's not a huge amount of clarity there, because I think about, for example, community foundations who might look enormous because they're sitting on, I don't know, 10 or 15 million pounds worth of endowment, and they're giving away maybe a million and a half pounds a year, but they've got 2.5 staff, you know. And so I'm just not sure that it's necessarily reflective of what the sector actually looks like in real terms. I think, for example, of you know, charities with heritage assets, or one of the charities I sit on, In Kind Direct, where we have donated goods and we value those donated goods in our balance sheet, but actually our charity is quite small. You know, it's more that we'd fall into tier two. But do you see what I'm getting at? So I'm just not sure it's really tackled those issues, actually. And but I do get that it's aimed to make it more proportionate. So I understand the thinking behind it. I'm not sure if it's necessarily going to achieve the objective, which is why I think we need to have really good debate about this and see, you know, not just what the finance professionals say, but those people, for example, who donate to charities or who read reports and accounts. Like, is this meaningful to them? I have no idea if that's helpful or not. But anyway, that's what popped into my head as I was reading
No,
it.
it is helpful, Deborah. Carol, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so I think there are two aspects to this. The first question is, are the limits right? And then, are the areas that that the various tiers are either included or excluded from appropriate? And those limits, I think, are really difficult to define in terms of where they should be. Because if you look at a charity that's, let's say, got 16 million income and therefore is in tier three, that's very different than a charity that's got 100 million or 150 million. And so is it fair to have all of those charities in that same banding? But I absolutely get it's difficult to have loads and loads of bands, so you've got to have the cutoff somewhere. And then in terms of the areas and whether those are sensible, I think from my perspective, that's really what I would like to hear in terms of this tiering question, because there, you know, a lot of this is under this SORP requires. So things are driven by the SORP itself that haven't come from FRS 102. So it is sort of within the gift of the SORP as to what charities have to do and don't have to do, which is very different from some of the technical things that I think we'll come on to in a moment, such as leasing, where you have to do that because it's in FRS 102. So this is where an area where I think there could be a lot of change driven by the consultation, if that's what the view of everybody responding says.
That's a great point, Carol.
Yeah,
Thank
it's
you.
a yeah, I think that's a great point. It might be interesting to know the feedback CFG's had on the threshold. So tier one, can I say, is unusual, and it includes a lot of very, very small organizations. And alongside the must requirements, the things they must do, there's also the additional language of should and may. So a question that's been raised in our consultation feedback is, would it have been better just to have a separate, simpler SORP for those kind of micro entities that is just must, so they don't have to get to grips with the other areas? There's also some thought around tier two that 500,000 seems like an awfully low threshold compared to 15 million. Of course, there's another government consultation underway right now looking at financial thresholds in charity law. And amongst those, the threshold for audit could increase from 1 million to 1.5. So some of those charities may become exempt from audit altogether. So moving on from the tiering, there are some other big changes relating to trustees' annual report. The most notable are around impacts and volunteers. Carol, can you explain a bit more about this?
Yeah, absolutely. So if I start off with impact, I mean, impact is something that has been talked about in the sector for more years than than I care to remember. It's sort of almost like the holy grail, and nobody ever gets there. So it's interesting to see what's in the SORP on that. And for the tier one charities, it is relatively simplistic. So it's really talking about, what way the work the charity has done makes a difference to beneficiaries, and whether there's also any benefit to society as a whole. And the SORP suggests that you might want to include statistics or testimonials or those sorts of things, which shouldn't be too difficult. And I suppose if I stood back and said, if I was involved in a charity and I wasn't able to say what difference I'd made to the beneficiaries, then that would seem a little bit odd because, the charities are there to make a difference to the beneficiaries. So if you couldn't sort of set a little bit of what difference you've made out in your trustees report, then as I said, I think that would be odd. Tiers two and three have to do quite a lot more, I think. So they have to explain the impact that they have made. But then the SORP goes on to use the word should. And then it talks about KPIs, outputs, outcomes, having the positives and having the negatives. So that's a little bit more than tier one, but one would hope that the sort of tier twos and tier threes would be more capable of doing that. But if you think that then applies for charities that have got income from 500,000 up to the largest charities in the land, that's quite a range that you're talking about there. So I suppose one of the things that people might come back and say is it fair to have exactly the same requirement for tier two and tier three around that? So that's impact. I don't know, Deborah, if you want to come in there and then we'll go back to volunteers, perhaps.
Yeah, sure. Happy to do that. The impact one I find quite challenging and quite difficult, and is the one I think really needs to be properly rethought and perhaps challenged. And what I mean by that is that actually, so if I take Direction of Social Change, for example, one of the things we do is we publish books, lots and lots and lots of books to help people do better at their jobs running charities. We have absolutely no idea whatsoever if the people who buy our books read them, if when they've read them, they implement them, if they share what they've learned with anybody else. And the only way we could find that out would cost us hundreds and hundreds of thousand pounds to track down every single purchaser of a book, even if we could do that. So I know, and that might sound like an unusual example, but actually that's very true across the piece. I don't know if you saw, for example, the is it the FRS have just published a report about the impact of Sure Start. Now, that's a longitudinal study. So Sure Start, for listeners who may not remember, was a programme that was implemented, I think, in the early days of New Labour. And it was about investing in families with young children at very, very young ages to put in place those things that are going to help those children to have better outcomes. There's no way of knowing what those better outcomes are until the kids have grown up. Now, the FRS has done this report. I think it's the FRS, isn't it? IFS, sorry, Institute of Physical Studies. They've done this report, which actually proves that I think the figures are for every £1 the government spent, it generated £2 of either savings or better results for their children. So it was clearly a good investment. But it was a longitudinal thing. I have no idea how much it costs to do that report, but I imagine the research cost must have cost well over £100,000 probably. So there's something about, yes, of course you want to know impact, but actually the effort it takes, particularly with some of our softer skills, youth clubs is another example. If you're like, how the hell do youth clubs report their impact? Actually, what they're doing is they're there to get kids off the street and engage in activities. But the benefits of that, you might not know for 5, 10, 15, 20 years. So I just think we've got to be really careful about this. And what I suspect what will happen is lots and lots of charities will end up like making performative statements about impact that they can't really back up with data. And I know the SORP says you can use, testimonials, that's enough, but it's not enough. I can find several people who say something good about one of my books. That doesn't mean my books are any good. Do you know what I mean? So I worry about that. And I think that needs to be thought, much better thought through, that this obsession with it. I personally, I think that inputs and outputs are a good measure. The question is, when you're reporting, have you done what you set out to do? And I think that's actually for most charities pretty good enough when it comes to impact reporting.
Again, I think those are all really good points, Deborah. And I know from feedback CFG has collated that charities would appreciate a lot more guidance in this area. Carol, could you talk us through the changes around volunteer reporting?
Well, in the current SORP, In the notes of the accounts, you should be disclosing the general role played by volunteers. In the new SORP, there is more now to be given in the trustees report, and all tiers of charity should be giving that information. And then also within the trustees report, you need to be providing for tiers 2 and 3 more information on the number of volunteers and, where practicable, the sort of full-time equivalent hours. And if we stand back and think, well, why is this required? Well, you know, you're not valuing in the income statement, so within the SOFA, the input of volunteers, but it can make a huge difference to the charity. So if there's nothing in the trustee report that really tells the story about the volunteers and what they're contributing, then you're really not getting an impression of the overall activity of the charity. But it is so difficult to come up with a reliable measure in terms of pounds that you know, I think that's why it falls back more on the actual hours. So I can absolutely see why that's required to give an idea of what the charity is doing within the trustees report. But it will then just boil down to, you know, how easy it is for charities to get that information. And it's probably best that is kept out of the financial pages of the accounts and within the trustee report, because the level of scrutiny is then a bit lower.
Yeah,
I completely agree with you, Carol, about that, for sure. I mean, I think, you know, we are, after all, the voluntary sector, you know, and I'm personally completely proud that that's what we are. And the vast majority of the things that we achieve as charities are because of volunteers. You know, when you actually look at the numbers, the number of charities that operate with almost entirely paid staff is minute. It's tiny in the scale of things. So volunteers are the beating, driving heart of what charities do. And I think where we can tell the story of how much they're contributing. I mean, I remember being completely shocked, you know, when I found out, for example, that Samaritans, and I'm forgetting the numbers now, so maybe we can, you know, someone can check this for me or, you know, can correct me. But that I think they had something like £11 million turnover, but something like 20,000 volunteers. And it was insane. And you look at that and you think, blimey, that's incredible. And you look at the RNI, for example, you know, these kinds of organisations with all their volunteers. So I think that the inclusion of stories about volunteers is wonderful. I agree with Carol. I'm super reluctant to put financial value against it because I just think it's meaningless. And also because trustees are volunteers too, you know, so how do you value a trustee as a volunteer at a higher rate than you'd value a, you know, I just think you get into all sorts of class, wealth and value issues that you really don't need to, because what you've got is decent, wonderful human beings supporting the work of your charity. So definitely love the requirement for more reporting, but yeah, keep it out of the notes and the numbers.
I think that's a good point. How much additional work would it take for charities to calculate the monetary value of those volunteers and trustees? I'd imagine it's a lot. So we've touched on two big changes to the trustee annual report, but there is another one. For the first time, charities will be asked to report on sustainability. It's pretty minimal for tiers 1 and 2, but there are some things mandated for tier 3. Carol, do you mind talking us through those?
It's absolutely clear that the way reporting is going generally for companies, it is to talk more about you know, environmental governance and social matters. So it's no great surprise that this is then coming in for charities, particularly when you then think about what charities are there to do. It clearly has only really been brought in for charities in tier 3, so above 15 million revenue, although, as you've just said, it is encouraged for tiers 1 and 2. But for tier 3, the requirement is to explain how the charity is responding and managing sort of environmental governance and social matters. So there isn't masses and masses on the SORP on it. But, you know, I'm imagining that over a period of time, people will become familiar with what is not so much required, because it's not specific in terms of necessarily what you have to put in there. But more what other people are doing, looking around at what companies are doing, and just, you know, moving towards best practice across the sector. You know, because this is, as you said, the first time this is in here. And if we think, you know, back to what we were just talking about in terms of impact reporting, you know, there have been requirements in the SORP, or rather, I shouldn't say requirements, but things that charities could decide to do about impact reporting. And the sector has gradually become more familiar with that. And maybe the same will then happen with sustainability reporting.
Yeah, this is one of those areas that I actually object to. I don't think it should be in there. And I feel quite strongly about it, actually. And I'll tell you why. It's not because I don't care about the environment. Of course, I care about the environment. But the purpose of a charity and its trustees is to deliver its charitable objects and services to beneficiaries in line with the law, whatever relevant laws there are. So there's already a requirement on charities anyway to comply with whatever environmental laws exist in their particular field. And I worry that by putting it in the SORP, what we're doing is we're requiring trustees to allocate resources to something that isn't core to the work of the charity. I know a charity, for example, that I got very enthusiastic about environmental issues because I've got lots of young people and they're super keen on it. And the charity ended up convincing itself into like recruiting some people whose job was just to look at their environmental sustainability. And I think they were spending something like 70 grand on the staff and various things. That's £70,000 that wasn't going to the core objectives of the charity, that wasn't in direct service. And it sort of plays into this whole thing like charities have got to be everything to everyone. Whatever it is, we've got to do it. We've got to be nice to everybody. We've got to look after the environment. We've got to, and I'm like, no, absolutely not. Your job as a board of trustees is to make sure that your charity is delivering in line with its charitable objectives for its beneficiaries. Anything you put, even if it's a nice to have in the SORP, it's going to have that subliminal effect of forcing trustees to think about allocating resources very differently. I think we'd be much, much better to create a campaign in the sector to get funders and government and all the rest of it to help charities to fund better environmental use. So like, you know, we want you to be better environmentally and here's a fund that's going to help you to, I can't think, you know what I mean, like do your recycling, whatever. But I absolutely don't think it should be a requirement of trustees to do it in the SORP, where it's, you know, where it, you'll be measured by whether you've done it or not.
Those are really interesting perspectives, and they quite fairly represent our members who are actually split on the issue of sustainability reporting. Some feel that for tier three, it doesn't go far enough, and others feel, as Deborah does, that it's not part of the core purpose of their charity. So we'll watch how this one develops with great interest. It'll be interesting to see how the final SORP ends up in that regard. I'd like now to talk about some of the more technical aspects of the new SORP, and particularly the changes in FRES 102. Carol, could you talk through lease accounting and income recognition and what's changing?
Yes, absolutely. I'll start off with leases, and this alongside income is really one of the main technical changes coming out of FRS 102 and thus the SORP. And as I said earlier, the SORP does have to follow FRS 102 on these technical areas. So there really was no choice but to bring in the provisions on leasing and income. So the leasing changes are essentially that the distinction between an operating lease and a finance lease has gone. So there will be far more leases on the balance sheet. And the way this works is you bring in what's called a right of use asset, and you bring in the finance lease liability, and then flowing through your SOFA, you've got an interest expense and depreciation. So that at a very high level is how it's treated. But not all arrangements will meet the definition of a lease, and there are some exemptions. So you're allowed to exclude low value assets, and that's in absolute terms, not in connection with the size of the charity. So if I give an example, one of the things that the SORP says is a laptop. So obviously a laptop is a far greater asset to a small charity than it is to a large charity. But that makes no difference. It's the absolute value of the actual item. So you'd need to work out what the low value assets are, and then you don't have to include those in that way. And then also you can look at short-term leases, and anything that is less than 12 months is a short-term lease, and again, doesn't have to be accounted in the way that I've just described. But then the sector has lease arrangements that the corporate world is very unlikely to have. So The charity sector has lots of peppercorn leases. I've seen those time and time again. And then also it has leases which are described in the SORP as a social donation lease. But that's where, for example, the lessor will give the charity the lease at a heavily discounted price. And thus they're getting a benefit through that. And so the SORP then goes through how the leases that are peppercorn and those that are the social donation leases are treated. Those that are peppercorn lease actually aren't treated in the same way as leases in the SORP, confusingly. Essentially, they're treated as a sort of donated asset or service, depending on what it is. Those that are a social donation lease, so at a discount but not at a peppercorn, you know, i.e. a pound or so, are treated as a lease, but with the donation amount treated at the start of the lease term. So that's the leasing side of things. It is very technical, and there's, you know, quite a big wadge of stuff in the SORP on it. And, you know, because it is so technical, there's a lot of technical language around it. And it's interesting, you know, talking to quite a few charities as this consultation period goes through. You know, a lot of people have been saying that they would like it in more plain English. They would like more examples so they can really understand what this is all about. So it will be interesting to read the consultation responses when they come through in this area. So before I go on to income, Deborah, have you got any thoughts? I mean, you know, on this whole concept of bringing the leases on. If not, I'll move on to income.
Carol, I genuinely don't.
That's fine.
You know, because it's one of those technical areas where I don't know what I think about it. You know, and of course, for us at DSC specifically, it doesn't affect us anyway because we're fully remote and we haven't got anything really that's on lease anymore. You know, we used to have photocopiers and such, never mind, you know, the buildings, and now we just have ourselves. So
yeah,
I can't be useful here, but you definitely
that's fine.
Can.
That's fine. And obviously a lot of charities' accounts will look quite different.
Yeah.
Because they're going to have a you know, in some cases, a large right of use asset and a large liability. So that, you know, that the whole balance sheet and obviously, you know, the bits that flow through the SOFA will look different. So yes, we'll have to see. And you know, that I think if you've got leases will be one of the more complex areas of the conversion to the new SORP. So then in terms of revenue, FRS 102 was updated to include what's called the 5-step model in IFRS, and then as I've already said on a number of occasions, it then has to flow into the SORP. So essentially what it's looking at is revenue being recognised when the entity transfers the control of whatever it is, so the goods or the services it's providing. So essentially it applies to an exchange transaction, not a non-exchange transaction. So, you know, non-exchange transactions are things like donations. So for many, it won't have an impact. But for those who have these exchange transactions, there is a lot to read. You know, again, it's a module with very many pages. So a lot to work through to think about your income and how this might apply. An example that I think is perhaps one of the easier examples that the SORP goes through is subscriptions, so member subscriptions. So if in essence your membership subscription is a donation, so you're not really getting anything in return, then that's a non-exchange transaction and you're accounting for it in the way that you have always accounted for it. But if you're purchasing rights to services or some sort of benefits, then you recognise that income as it is earned by the charity. So the example that the SORP gives in this for this one is if part of your membership, you get a pass to enter the gardens of the charity as often as you like over the period of your membership, then essentially you're satisfying that performance obligation by keeping those gardens open. But then you don't know how often a member will visit. So if you're thinking about, well, I've got to allocate the membership subscription as I deliver that performance, which essentially will be the member coming into the garden, you can't recognise that income as a proportion of each time they visit, because that's just not possible. So you're going to have to come up with a method of allocating that membership subscription. And fortunately, the SORP does come up with the very sensible idea that one approach might be to measure it on a straight line over the period of the subscription. So that will make life easy in that instance. But I think there'll be a lot of instances where it absolutely isn't easy and where there isn't an example in the SORP that people can look at and follow. Because if you think about the sector, there's a huge diversity of sources of income, and the SORP simply can't give an example for everyone. So I think for those charities with exchange transactions, there will be quite a lot to think about in terms of income recognition.
I think that's a really good summary of these technical aspects of lease accounting and income recognition, Carol. So thanks for that. Deborah, what are your thoughts on income recognition? Do you think charities could do with more support with this?
To be honest, when it comes to sort of where you recognize income, rather than the level of detail that we require, when producing the accounts, it's more about how difficult it is to explain the income in your actual annual report and account to the readers of the account so they actually understand. Because as you know, people, it just back is basic a level of, understanding the difference between restricted and unrestricted reserves, for example, understanding what reserves means in the first place, also, understanding. And we've had the age-old battle about, allocating the cost of fundraising against the fundraising income. And, people talk about, people get very confused about that stuff. So I actually think there's a little bit more work we could do to help make that clearer generally. Whether the SORP is the place to do that, I don't know. I'm not sure it is. But I think that lots of the requirements of how we account for stuff are actually very confusing for the readers of the accounts, because it's, well, absolute classic example, accounting for grants. You're promised £300,000 over 3 years. You've got to account for that £300,000 in the year that it's promised, even though you're not going to get the cash until each year in which it's delivered. That can leave a very distorting picture of the, health of your charity, actually. And also then it, because you're spending it down, for lots of people who don't understand, it looks like you're making a loss when you're not. You're just spending the money that you were given. So I think things like that, I mean, I personally think that could be done better, but I'm not sure this SORP is the place that that's going to happen. I think that requires longer conversations with people who are clever about this stuff than I am.
It's interesting to hear your views on that. We know that CFG's members, that more examples and decision trees are always appreciated. So that thought leads nicely onto my next question. What can charities do now to prepare for the new published SORP? Carol, can I come to you on that one?
So I think if you stand back and look at the consultation draft, clearly there are going to be whole swathes that aren't going to change dramatically because they're bringing in the things from FRS 102, so leasing and income and so forth. So I would definitely start thinking about it now. So from a lease perspective, start looking at what leases you've got, because a lot of charities may not be immediately familiar with this is the list of our leases, these are the documents, this is how we would interpret it. So to start thinking and gathering the information in. And then as soon as the actual SORP comes out, start thinking about the trustees' annual report, because there are a lot of things in there that we've already talked about. Don't leave it until your first year when you have to report under the SORP. So if you're a charity that's got to do the reporting on sustainability, then start thinking about how you're going to do that so that you can gather the information as you go through the year, rather than actually having to just try and do it all post year, and you were thinking, well, I wish I'd gathered that information as I'd gone through. So I think it's really, you know, preparing as soon as you can, and also getting the trustees familiar with what the changes are going to be.
So, Deborah, your charity is going to have to implement many of these changes. What will your team be doing to prepare? What will you be talking about with your staff?
Well, the very first and most important thing I would say is most of us are not going to have the time or the headspace to actually think about this or go into any detail or even necessarily understand it. And it's a very, very short consultation period. I mean, this is supposed to be going live from January, I think, isn't it? And I forget what the consultation period ends really soon. So absolutely engage with your sector bodies who are working on this. Obviously, organisations like Charity Finance Group are doing brilliant work, but most of the others, NCBO will be feeding into it. We will at DSC, you know, we'll be reflecting views. So keep an eye on what they're saying, you know, read the articles, you know, read the newsletters, etc. Also, local CVSs will definitely be looking at it. So you can rely on your infrastructure bodies to be doing a lot of this work, but don't rely on them blindly. Like, make sure you know what it is they're saying and what it is they're doing. The second actually key thing for me, which I think has perhaps been overlooked, is certainly this first iteration of the new SORP is going to require more work by auditors. And more work by auditors is going to be a bigger cost. So I think one of the things charities definitely need to be thinking about is when you're budgeting for your audit fees for the coming year, you need to expect that it's probably going to be a bigger bill because there are more requirements. I mean, on the audit, and in fact, auditors, of course, already having to jump through a billion different loops because you know, the reporting restrictions for them are so tight, you know, that absolutely trickles down. So I think, you know, from a practical point of view, for goodness sake, you know, at the very least, pick up the phone to your auditor and say, look, you know, give me a rough idea. Is my fee going to double next year, or do I have a chance of like keeping it lower? And what can I do to keep it lower? And then I think the final thing is your own auditor and accountant, where it's relevant to you, they will almost definitely be reading this, talking about it amongst themselves, and very probably inputting into it either themselves directly or through their own professional bodies like the ICAEW, whatever. So do speak to your own accountants and your own auditors about what do they think about the SORP and how do they think it's going to affect you. Our auditors at our last meeting when we signed off our annual report and accounts actually talked to us about some of the changes that were coming and explained how it wasn't relevant to us, so we didn't need to worry. So reassuring for my board of trustees. You know, if I'd said it to them, it would not have carried as much weight as it did when our auditors said, and by the way, here's what's coming next year, but don't worry, most of it doesn't affect you.
That's really good practical advice, Deborah. Final question from me. Is there anything else that charities should be aware of, or any final thoughts or advice?
Nothing specific, because it's all little sort of fiddly things, really. I would say sort of an overarching point or a couple of points is that transparency is critical, but so is proportionality. And I think we have to, you know, be very sensible about more information is not necessarily better information. You know, we've got to come back to always what is the purpose of the trustees' annual report and accounts, because all the SORP is a guide for that. So I think we've got to keep coming back to, is this SORP guidance going to make for better reporting and report and accounts, more transparent, more obvious? I'm not convinced it is. And I think that's what needs to be tested. You know, that requiring more stuff does not necessarily make for better information.
And from my perspective, and I suppose coming at it from a different way, is turn to the back of the SORP, look at Appendix 4, the basis for conclusions, because that takes you through an awful lot of the changes and why they are being made. And I found that quite a good place to go to make sure that I'm understanding everything that has changed and the whys. So when looking at that consultation, do turn to Appendix 4 and have a read through, because that isn't too long. I don't know how many pages, but it's probably about 20 pages. So I've personally found that quite a good starting place for some of my thoughts.
Great points, Carol. Really, really good point. You can skip out the technical bit in the middle, just read the first 35 pages and the last 20.
No, I completely agree with that. Appendix 4 has been crucial for many of us, I'm sure. No, there were some really, really helpful comments and conversation there. Brilliant hearing from both of you, and that's been really useful, I'm sure, both for myself selfishly, but also I'm sure for our members and charities listening. One final quick PSA from me, I suppose, and that's to urge charities to engage with this process and the consultation, both by responding to it yourself. If there's only one issue you're really concerned about, you're able to via the survey. So if it's just sustainability reporting or just the guidance on leasing, please do look at the consultation itself. If you want to help CFG, which I'm sure you will do, I would urge you to complete the survey that's been sent to you as well. So that would be really, really helpful. And of course, we'll be putting on a full suite of trainings come the autumn when the final draft is out to get you prepared for accounting period starting 1st of January 2026 as well. So I'd like to thank both Deborah Alcott-Tyler and Carol Roach for joining us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah, great stuff. I love the soap. I love sitting on the committee when I did. I love this stuff, honestly. So anybody listening, please don't be intimidated by it. It really can be actually good fun. And the arguments you get into over what you're going to report elsewhere can highlight your day, honestly.
Brilliant. Couldn't agree more, Deborah. Thank you so much for this conversation. It's been really helpful.